I'm William Andreessen, host of Speaking with Students, a part of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to now. Shows in the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other interesting education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back. Steve here. And today I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Furlich, a higher ed professor, researcher, communications expert, and author. His latest book is Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. What a powerful episode. You are going to learn so much about that nonverbal stuff we do when we talk with people, when we interact with people, and in our world, you know, the kids, the parents, our peers. Yeah, a lot going on here. You're going to learn so much. You're going to love this. Thanks for listening. Oh, by the way, before you go, you know, there's a couple different ways you could help out the podcast. One of them would be, you know, tell a friend, share the links. Another would be go to my website and leave a review and subscribe. You could do that at stephenmoleto.com. And the last one would be click on the link on my website homepage. You'll see it. It says buy me a coffee. Click on that. And by doing this, you could go in and donate a dollar or two to help me address the costs associated with producing the podcast. What do you think? Could you do that for me? That'd be so cool. You are awesome. Enjoy the show.
So one of the things that I think is really important for maybe those who teach the K-12, it's been found that with law enforcement interrogators, that their nonverbal behaviors, when they question a child, it actually influences the child's responses. So I think the K-12 particularly, or anyone who works with children or has children, need to understand after reading my book how their nonverbal behaviors influence the responses of the child themselves. So we need to try to be as neutral as possible.
It's the Education Podcast, your favorite show, with lots of groovy guests and they share what they know. So crank it up to 10 and let your neighbors know that here's another show with Dr. Steve Mileto. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. With Dr. Steve Mileto.
Dr. Stephen Furlich is the author of Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. He is also the best-selling author of a breakthrough book, Sex Talk, How Biological Sex Influences Gender Communication Differences Throughout Life Stages. He has taught and researched communication at the university level for over 20 years. He has taught a variety of communication courses with the main focus of better understanding oneself and others. Often his research projects and the courses that he taught complemented each other and led into innovative directions. Dr. Furlich has been an associate professor at Texas A&M University since 2018 and served as an assistant principal there for 5 years prior to that. He has presented at many conferences, including DFW Metroplex Linguistics Conference, Society for Information Technology and Teacher Education Conference, E-Learning Conference, National Communication Association Conference, Southern States Communication Association Conference, International Academy of Business and Public Administration Disciplines, and International Conference of the American Pragmatics Association. Dr. Furlich, who was recently interviewed by One America News Network, has been published in numerous journals, including Texas Speech Communication Journal, Kentucky Journal of Communication, the Florida Communication Journal, Journal of Applied Communication Research, Academic Exchange Quarterly, Journal of Integrated Social Sciences, and Journal of the Scholarship of Teaching and Learning. His communication paradigm is from a receiver's perspective. This places the emphasis on the listener to better understand from the speaker's perspectives and as a speaker emphasizing understanding from the listener's perspectives. Both of these become more challenging as differences increase between the speaker and listener. Dr. Furlich has become fascinated with technological advancements in science that have enabled a better understanding of communication. Without these scientific advances, understanding communication is quite limited. This line of research has inspired him to write this book to bring together many different scientific studies to better understand the role of biology with nonverbal communication cues. He earned a Doctor of Philosophy in Higher Education, a Master of Arts in Communication Studies, and a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology from Texas Tech University. He resides in McKinney, Texas. Stephen, thanks so much for being on the show, and say hi to everybody.
Hi, thanks for having me back, Steve. And thanks for your interest in this topic and for your audience as well, their interest.
Well, it's great to have you on again. Welcome back. And we've had just a little couple of years between our last communication over your previous book, Sex Talk, which was quite fascinating also. And so you have a real good connection with some really cool topics here. And nonverbal is one that I think gets a lot of people's attention, especially when you may or may not know. I'm sorry, I'm a former principal, and there's nothing better than meeting with a faculty in a high school, and you got them in the auditorium, and you're talking with them, and you know, there's a lot of nonverbal communication going on out there.
Right.
So I'm looking forward to this talk. Your book looks awesome. It reads awesome. And I love the fact that you have pictures in it too, which really emphasize, help make connections, I guess is my point. So good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So Stephen, you know, it's great to have you back. And our focus today is your book, Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. Let's start with this. What is nonverbal communication?
And that's a good question. Whenever you explore an area, it's always good to have a common understanding, define what your major terms are. And that's what I try to do in my class and the book as well. So one of the things that I really wanted to accomplish in my book, Nonverbal Epiphany, is to cover a variety of different topics related to nonverbal communication. Too often I hear in popular culture or just casual conversations with people outside of academia, just say body language. And they think often, too often, that it's just what we do with our gestures. But there's a lot of other areas as well. So I try to have a definition that's much more comprehensive and expansive, that it's all communication except for the words themselves. So it does include body movements, but also facial expressions, use of touch, movement, so use of proximity. Everyone's familiar with those different proximic zones. Body features, different features that we have in our body and how they relate to other features as well, what that communicates. Olfactics, the use of odors, colors, how that influences our behaviors, the clothes that we wear, the environment, so the classroom, the way that you arrange it, vocal expressiveness, tone, rate, speech, images, and different designs such as the golden ratio. So a lot of it, I think, are areas that people just aren't really that aware of, that these are influencing our behaviors and those of others.
Very cool. It's interesting because they're, like you said, that's another reason why I'm very fascinated by this, because it's more than just, you know, body language, like you said. And there, you hear that mentioned a lot because there's all kinds of stuff there. But all you got to do, once again, my audience is educators. So all you got to do is work with kids and especially be an assistant principal. And you'll get a lot of different nonverbal communication that's not necessarily body language. So, but I love what you're talking about. All right. So why'd you write Nonverbal Epiphany? I mean, who's your audience? Who are you shooting for there?
So one of the things that I've done for over 10 years is taught a class, nonverbal communication. And taking that earlier, growing up, I was always interested in social behaviors. And I wasn't as informed, because us males tend not to be as informed nonverbally in terms of understanding other people. And there's biological reasons for that we get into later. So that's why I tried to read as much on nonverbal communication as I could. And then when I went to the university as an undergrad, I took a nonverbal class. As a graduate, I took a nonverbal class. And then I've taught at the university level for over 10 years a nonverbal class. And I couldn't find a book that met my needs. So inside academia, there's plenty of nonverbal communication books, but they're very theoretical and not nearly as applied as what people could use is what I would like and what most people would like. And then outside of academia, there's plenty of body language, nonverbal books out there, but they're not really that research-based. So how credible is it? I try to combine the two. I try to have it that's applied, that people could use, that's research-based. And I also try to throw in biology and activities as well, so people could not just learn about nonverbal communication, but improve it as well. And one of the things that you talked about is the images. I have over 150 images so that people can actually see and apply and make the abstract ideas concrete. So there's nothing that's adult content that I think. So I think anywhere from ages 12 to maybe senior citizens would find it interesting and useful as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, you got me thinking about when I was reading your book and stuff like this. I mean, there's any number of things that, you know, back in the in the 90s, this was very popular, although you still see it some, which is, talk to the hand, not to the face. But something that's it seems to have never gone away and always be there is rolling of the eyes. Hey, class, today we're going to talk about 1066. What do you know? And, suddenly you got eyes rolling. Or, hey, guys, need you to move on to class. Yeah, there's all kinds of nonverbal communication that could happen there.
One of the themes is going beyond words. So what are we saying when we're not talking?
I love it. That's good stuff. And we need to train. We need a lot of training in this, especially, I would think that no matter where you work, if you're in some sort of leadership position or in a role like an educator, where you're in there's a little bit of hierarchy there, that you need to learn a little bit about how that works, how it looks, what it might be communicating to you. Cause I know it's, if you just pay attention and you're talking and they're lost, you can tell suddenly you get on the kids who are never lost. They're kind of like, huh? but if you just keep on driving on, man, that's bad too. So good stuff. I mean, so I've just talked about a couple of examples. I mean, my audience is educators of all types, from K through 12 and beyond. Why should the adults who work in schools want to learn about nonverbal communication?
So for two reasons. One is one of the things that you touched on was they have a more accurate understanding of students themselves. So trying to understand the students on a more personal level and more accurately as well, because the majority of our communication is nonverbal. So maybe observe their social interactions and try to understand what their social abilities are and how well are they socializing with other students. So one of the things that really helps bring people together, groups together, students together is empathy, understanding other people. And one of the things that you can nonverbally observe is mimicry. So how does each student or the people you're working with, how much do their nonverbal behaviors mimic the other people around them, their nonverbal behaviors? And that's a good indicator of empathy. And if they don't, let's say there's a group of five students, four have similar nonverbal behaviors, one does not, do they not socially understand other people? Or is there something psychologically going on personality-wise that they don't empathize with other people nearly as much? Another one that's, you've probably seen this in a classroom, of empathy, yawn contagion. So if one person yawns and then another person and then other people yawn, that's been found to be indicator that they empathize with each other as well. So when you empathize with other people, you understand them and you understand their emotional state as well much more. One of the things that probably most of your audience has gone through when we had just a few years ago, I'm old enough to remember what life was like before the coronavirus. And then during the coronavirus, there's a lot of social isolation. So what were some of the effects that came out from that? There's a lot of research over the decades that shows isolation from other people, how that affects our senses, our time, and our reality as well. So it distorts our overall being when we're not able to socialize and interact with other people. So decades ago, orphanages, they had a high mortality rate. They met all the needs of the babies, the food, the water, the shelter. They couldn't understand why. And then eventually they figured out that they needed that social interaction and touch. And then when they had that, the health improved and the mortality rates dropped dramatically just by having that social interaction, the use of touch. Because what that does is it increases your oxytocin level, that bonding chemical with other people, reduces your stress. Cortisol levels, it's also been found with deer when it's overcrowded. They have plenty of food, plenty of shelter, but they tend to get more disease and die off because of their stress. The cortisol level increases as a reduce of having the overcrowding. So it's a balance, not having too much people around you, too much stress, overcrowding, and not being deprived of it as well. So one of the things that I think it's really important for maybe those who teach the K-12, it's been found that with law enforcement interrogators, that their nonverbal behaviors, when they question a child, it actually influences the child's responses. So I think the K-12 particularly, or anyone who works with children or has children, need to understand after reading my book how their nonverbal behaviors influence the responses of the child themselves. So we need to try to be as neutral as possible. Also, the classroom, the arrangement. So if you have more circular desks, circular arrangement of students as opposed to just those rows, students find that arrangement more interesting. They learn more and they interact with other students and find them more interesting as well. Same thing, I lay out multimedia, using technology, using colors to increase student attention. And one of the things that I'm working on now as an article, I'm going to more in depth than what I did in my book, but I do touch on it some, that it's been found that the presenter, so a teacher, where they stand on the particular side of, if you want to call, quote, quote, the stage, that's going to influence the brain activations of the audience, the student, and it's going to be more effective if they stand on one side of the stage, if they want more humor, and if they stand on the other side of the stage, if they want more emotion. So just, I'll just briefly touch on that. Comedians have known for decades, laugh from the left, cry from the right. So the comedians left, they stand if they want to deliver something that is supposed to be humorous, because what that does is it activates language, and humor has been found to activate the left side of the brain for audience members who receives it, but also standing on the left, the visual field, both eyes have the activation going through the left side of the brain as well. Whereas if you stand on the right side and you use emotion, both emotion activates the right side of the brain, regardless of where you stand. But then again, the visual field, if you stand on the right, that's going to activate the right side of the audience as well. So I think this book would be good for anyone who teaches maybe a health class, a psychology class, or some sort of home economics class. Can you think of any particular classes this book would be good for?
Well, in particular, I was thinking about especially new teachers, but all teachers and administrators. I want to break them up into two separate groups for a minute, because as a classroom teacher, I think one of the things that's important to recognize is that there are signs from your kids when, you know, if you don't recognize it, that, and let's forget about it being towards the teacher. It's just that if you don't recognize that something's going on, because let's say the kid's name's Jimmy, you know, Jimmy normally is involved doing this, that, and the other, talking to people around him. You maybe have to shush him once in a while or something like this. But today he's sitting there and he's not interacting and he's looking straight ahead and there's no smile. And, you know, some adults just, boom, would just smooth right on by that. And you never know if, you know, maybe Jimmy's getting ready to turn and slug the guy sitting right next to him or something, or maybe it has nothing to do with anything like that. And it's, you know, you don't know. And then the other, if we talk about administrators, the same sort of way, that when they interact with kids and, you know, their team members, you know, recognizing when there's something going on there and it's not, they're not interested in what I'm saying, or, you know, they've got something to say, but they're not saying it. And, you know, stuff like that. I think that a lot of times that's how, you know, because there's a lot of work on cultures and in schools and stuff like that. And, you know, when an adult doesn't, who's in a leadership position, doesn't recognize the other person, or doesn't make somebody feel like they can talk to them about whatever the issue is. I think all, you know, the stuff that you talk about with nonverbal, I think it's just so important to recognize that. And so it goes all the different directions, interacting with the kids, interacting with the parents, interacting with the teachers, and teachers with the administrators. And so anyway, that's what I was thinking about.
That's good. So one of the things that I try to put out some principles out there, PLES. and one of them is, when you think of nonverbal communication, it's pieces of a puzzle. So it's individual pieces of evidence, like you just described. So not to overgeneralize from one piece of evidence, but then also not to ignore each piece either. So one piece, they're not interacting with someone else, a blank stare, and not having the facial expressiveness that they usually have, and not mimicking other people's behaviors. And then where are they distance? Where do they sit or stand? Is it farther away from other people than what they usually do? So all those things coming together, use of space, mimicry, and putting all those facial expressions together as well. So those are all good points. Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. I just think that the subject is so important to me because educators are people. I mean, you work with people. I mean, that's what you do all day long. And it's, you know, if you got into it for anything other than that, it's like, well, I think you chose the wrong field. So your subject here, the content just fits right with what a lot of times adults make mistakes. It's in this area, and who didn't read that one right? But anyway, good stuff. One of the things I wanted to bring up is something you mentioned at the beginning, which is in chapter 5, you talk about nonverbal communication and gender. Let's talk about that.
I tend to take a stand that the research supports it as well. So however controversial it is, I'll throw that out there, that males and females are born biologically different in terms of their abilities nonverbally. So it's been found consistently that females, girls at an early age, they one have more interest in social interactions. They look at faces much more so. Boys, they tend to look at objects and motion. And it's been found consistently from an early age that females, girls, going up all the way through women, they tend to outperform males when it comes to empathy, understanding other people, nonverbal cues, having more interest in it, and being able to more accurately send their nonverbal messages as well. So just like in my previous book, Sex Talk, I have a whole chapter on, I call it Women's Sixth Sense. And here are some of the different biological reasons why females outperform us males, understanding and sending nonverbal behaviors. So they have a more integrated brain. And that's one of the epiphanies that really stood out to me, is they have much more connections across both hemispheres and more overall brain activation during social interactions. So what that allows females to do is to engage in the conversation while at the same time analyze the other person's nonverbal behaviors, whereas us males, we have more connections within each hemisphere, so we're much more compartmentalized. We could do one or the other, but expecting us to do both at the same time isn't as realistic as what it is for females. And they also have more white matter overall, brain white matter, and that helps the different areas of their brain, like we already talked about. It's more activated overall, more of it during social interactions, and it helps to communicate to the different areas as well. They also have a better ability with senses. They could look at just someone's eyes and identify the other person's emotion from that alone, much better than what males can. They have more mirror neurons that are activated during social interactions, and that prepares their body to display the nonverbal behaviors that they see someone else. So if your body is preparing to display the same nonverbal behaviors, then you take on that emotion and you empathize with the other person much more so. They have that higher levels of oxytocin during social interactions, which is that bonding chemical. So again, you identify with the other person, you bond with them much more so. And estrogen helps social understanding, and testosterone hinders social understanding. So it's these sex hormones that are sort of like the oil in the engine, and it helps it run. So one of the things that I like to stress, they also have better color vision, because color vision's on the X chromosome. And if you have two X chromosomes, then why would you think that you wouldn't have better color vision? And they have more P cells in the retina. So they literally see the world maybe in more color, more like a color movie, and we see it more in black and white. And they have better peripheral vision, whereas we see better straight ahead. So the bottom line with all that is that often us men, we tend, or males, boys, we tend to oversimplify communication and take a more literal understanding. And females, they tend to analyze it at a much deeper level. And sometimes maybe they overanalyze or overcomplicate it. So the same student, if it's a male, they may just give a few words as a response, and they may not pick up on nearly as many nonverbal cues. Whereas if it's a female, she's much better able to give more detail and expand on that particular topic of the exact same thing and pick up on more of those nonverbal cues. So I think people need to take that into consideration of the response is going to be different from male and female, and the way they see the world and the way that they socially interact is going to be different as well.
That's awesome. I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting because it's so fascinating, because there's so many different ways that people could run over this knowledge, just run over. I mean, it's literally like a Mack truck, boom, because by not knowing what they're seeing and or what's helping, you know, deal, whatever the communication the verbal communication that's happening, they may not realize that there's other stuff being said here, just not verbally. And I think this is so powerful to know about the differences in the gender. Now, one of the things, I mean, I know my audience can't see me, but I have to hold back some smirks and laughs during this time, because there are several comedians who have gotten into this sort of concept right here. One of my favorite from the South, his name is Jeff Foxworthy, and he talks about how men literally can think of nothing. He says, "Why don't women understand that? They went, so tell me what you're thinking about. You're thinking about something right now. Oh, I'm thinking about nothing." So anyway, it's just differences between men and women. So not so scientific on his part, but
this is cool. Actually, it is that in my previous book, the Sex Talk book, I have a whole chapter called The Man Trance, and basically that we have less variability in our heart rate when we rest and less brain activation as well. So what that indicates is we have less emotional influence on us when we rest, whereas with females, they have much more emotional influence when they're trying to rest. So it's much more difficult for them to try and rest than it is for us. And they need to understand that if we're in the rest state, not to try and have a deep conversation with us, because it's just going to frustrate both.
I like that. That explains a lot too. That's without going into my whole life. That explains a lot right there. Good stuff. All right. So I gotta make sure that I talk about this. You have this whole area that you talk about called communobiology, and I think I said it right. I hope I said it.
Yes.
What's share what its focus is all about? What that part of your book's about?
So I take the stand, and I think research supports me on this, is that you can't separate biology from communication. One is all communication starts in the brain, so that's biological. And as I already touched on a little bit, our sex hormones influence it as well. So how does our biology influence our communication, and how does our communication influence our biology? So just briefly touching on what we just talked about with gender differences, when it comes to dating, relationships, what often starts out is chemo signals. So we all give off the subconscious type of odors. And what happens often is the female tries to sniff out a potential mate who's a male, and she wants someone who has a genetically different type of chemo signal DNA, because we all have recessive genes that aren't expressed, and these are usually detrimental ones. So if you have too close of DNA, then it increases the chances that our recessive genes are going to be expressed. So she often starts, she often initiates some sort of romantic interest by standing closer, pointing her feet towards the other person, longer eye contact, playing with her hair. And then after that, she expects the male to escalate it and take the lead from there. So that's some interaction of biology and communication. So what I go into more detail in this book, Nonverbal Epiphany, is the mind and body connection. Oftentimes, people often think that our nonverbal communication is a reaction to the social interaction, and that's true. But people don't realize is that our nonverbal behaviors can actually create the emotion as well. So you have emotion that's created from action. So I touch in our book, I cite Cuddy. Her last name is Cuddy. And she talks, and she's done numerous research studies that our nonverbal behaviors can create the emotion. So she talked about the power pose, and you have your legs standing a little bit farther apart. You have your hands on your hips, your elbows out, a more expansive posture. And she had two different groups. One group do it, group A, group B did not. And people who did, they conducted an interview, a panelist, and the panelist did not see who did it. And they rated the group A who did it prior to the interview, before they walked in the power pose, which they did not see again, as being much more credible, more confident, more likely to get the job. Two biological reasons. One is it increased their testosterone levels, which increased their confidence. And two, it lowered their cortisol levels, their stress hormone levels. So what our nonverbal behaviors do actually creates our emotion. Another study has found that two different groups, one group A, they put a pin in their mouth, group B, they did not. Afterwards, what was their emotional state rated afterwards? Group A rated as much more positively. Why? Having a pin in your mouth, what's that do? That creates an artificial smile. So the artificial smile actually created the emotion again. One of the things I also indicate are principles. PLE, is that whatever happens first, micro expressions, is usually truer. So wherever happens quickest and first is usually truer, and on the left side of the face as well. Wherever it starts on the left side is often truer as well. We all have 5 to 7 universal emotions: happy, surprise, sad, fright, disgust, contempt, anger. Everybody shares those regardless of culture, but it's our culture that influences the way that we express it. How do we express it? One of the things that has been found is emotional contagion. So what one person's emotion is, other people actually take on that emotion oftentimes. So that's why you need to keep an eye on that with students. If you have one student that's whatever, causing trouble, negative, disruptive, then how quickly you probably observe that other students take on that as well, because negative emotions transfer much more easily than positive ones. And then two last things is pupil dilation. What people usually have interest in, their pupils often dilate. So what happens is when you see a new stimuli, your pupils dilate in less than a second automatically, and then they stay dilated if it's something you like, or they contract if it's something that you dislike in less than a second as well. So you can often see what people have interest in. Jewelry dealers have known about this for years. Poker players have known about this as well. That's why they wear those sunglasses. And then lastly, epigenetics. So the behaviors and experiences that we involve today influences, it doesn't change your DNA, but it changes how our DNA is expressed in our offspring. So your diet, your exercise, and your experiences around 3 to 4 months prior to conception is going to influence how your DNA is expressed in that offspring.
That's so cool. And you mentioned something that as I'm listening to you and I was reading this section, you know, I like to tell people that I shouldn't play poker. And because I can't control my expressions. And, you know, it's one of the things when I was in basic training in the Army, I did a lot of push-ups because there were some things that it was just funny what he was yelling at me about. And I had to smile. And hence I did something that's known as pushing the earth away from the sun. So, what powerful knowledge right there to understand a little bit deeper you're teaching us. Good stuff.
Just briefly, you brought up poker, and what's actually been found in research is what's a better indicator is not look at someone's face during a poker tournament. And you can take this into life as a metaphor, but their extremities. Their extremities are a truer indicator of their intention. So how confident are they with their hand and their arm when they move the chips in towards the middle of the table for a bluff or genuine? And same thing when you have a conversation with someone, where do their feet point? Is it straight at you? They're engaged in the conversation, or is one pointed towards the door because their intention is that they want to leave and not have that conversation. Another thing that you brought up is doing push-ups. That's actually been found to increase testosterone levels, so exercise and diet. And we talked about how that influences our social behaviors as well. So there's hot topics in the media, K-12, society, whatever else. We don't know how epigenetics, how that influences later generations. Trying to legalize narcotics in every state or different states, different types, different severities of it. What's that going to do to future generations in the way our DNA is expressed? Same thing with changes artificially, sex hormone levels. That's going to influence our behaviors and then epigenetics as well. So I think there's a lot of topics out there that we just don't need to jump into in terms of fully accepting it without critically analyzing what's the long-term effects.
Awesome. I appreciate you talking about this, because this is fascinating to me, and especially because in my world, we interact with people. I mean, it's what we do, and it's only going to be helpful to us the more we understand who it is and how they react to what we're doing, you know, and how they interact with us. So good stuff. All right, so one of the things I got to make sure I mention is this. Throughout your book, you include activities. They're at the ends of chapters and such, and they usually are multiple step. Could you talk about why you included these?
That's a good question. So one of the things I want readers to do is not just learn about nonverbal communication, but actually improve it themselves. Improve upon how you understand other people much more accurately, but then also improve your behaviors. How do you send those messages much more effectively as well? So for your audience, probably everyone, this would be a good topic. Bloom's taxonomy is what I was trying to address and touch on. So those different stages of learning through Bloom's taxonomy, you remember first, then you understand, then you apply, then you analyze, then you evaluate, and then you create yourself. So we go from simple learning of earlier in the chapter, just some basic terminology, into how can you use it, and then also how can you evaluate and then create it yourself. And then secondly, I just thought it's a fun way to learn by actually doing. In my nonverbal class, when I teach it, part of their grade is to do one or two of those activities each week and then submit half a page or a page of how they did the activity and what they learned from it. So what do you learn and how can you apply it is what I try to stress.
I love that. It's awesome. And you do. I mean, I was reading each of those sections and it would be definitely a strong reinforcer of what you're talking about and a new learning moment. So good stuff. You know, one of the things that comes out of this is that, and you talk about it, is people misreading people. So let's talk about that. Do people really misread facial and body movements? You know, why is it important to recognize that as a possibility that you might be misreading them?
So one of the things is that people usually emphasize and put much more weight on other people's nonverbal over their verbal, and that is the correct way to go. But there's a lot of misunderstanding and misconceptions out there. So there's a percentage in my book, and I don't have it off the top of my head, but I was surprised by it, a large percentage of all of our conversations. There's a large percentage that involves some level of deception. And professionals themselves, interrogators, military, FBI, whoever it is, they're only able to detect accurately deception about 60%, just barely over 50%, 50-50 chance. Why is that? Because they have not read my book. No, I'm just kidding. but it is because of not having as research-based knowledge on the topic. So one of the things that's very difficult to try to mislead is the biology behind it. So if someone looks to the left during the conversation, and that's often an indicator of truth. If they look to the right, that's often an indicator that they're trying to imagine something or they're trying to fabricate something. So looking to the left often activates the emotional side of the brain and the right side of the brain and the areas of detail that we're trying to convey. Whereas if it's to the right, that activates the left side of the brain and they're trying to fabricate through language. So looking to the left has been found consistently with right-handed people, like 90% accuracy that it's truth. And then looking to the right, that people are trying to fabricate. Also, if someone's trying to be disingenuous, this is something that people most are mistaken about, is they often look for eye contact. And what research has actually found is when someone's trying to be deceptive, they maintain eye contact for longer periods of time than what they normally do, because they know that's what someone else is looking for. That's what popular culture movies have told us as well. So you want to understand someone's baseline. How do they normally communicate? And are they doing something different than what they normally do? And are they maintain an eye contact for longer periods of time than what they normally do? Again, we talked about the extremities, the feet, the hands, that often indicates what their true intentions are. They usually do, and this is one of the big people in our research area, they often do repetitive and simpler behaviors. So they don't do as many different types of behaviors as what they usually do in terms of gestures, hand gestures, but they do the same ones and they do it over and over. Why is that? Because it's cognitively daunting and exhaustive and takes a lot of energy to deceive. Think about what you just talked about that's not true. Think about what you're about to talk about that's not true. Have it make sense. Try to add some detail oh, and by the way, try to do some sort of natural nonverbal behaviors. It's very difficult. So you do fewer ones and the same ones over and over, and it's less spontaneous. And the bottom line also is that females are much better able to detect deception from others because they're much better able to read the senses from others than what males are. So there's a number of different tips in there to understand if someone's being deceptive or not. What direction do they look at, their extremities, their level of eye contact, how they normally communicate, and other things as well.
You know, it, one of the things, this is really terrible news because this means that anybody who's trying to figure out how to get out of trouble or something like this, they're just all messed up now.
This must be only used for good.
There you go. There you go. I like that. That's, you know, it's, when you're an assistant principal in a school, one of the things that happens a lot of times is the kids, you know, trying to balance whether should I lie? Should I tell a story? Should I do whatever? If they're, you know, if they did whatever it is that you're asking them about. And it's just funny because sometimes you look at, I've looked at a kid and said, come on, do I have a neon sign above my head that says lie to me? I mean, come on, we know this is not, and a lot of times when you say something like that, they kind of look one direction or another, and then they start talking to you about what the real thing is. And it's like, you know, but, you know, it's just funny because I got to tell you, it makes me paranoid now. I'm worried that I'll just have to sit still, perfectly still. Still not look either direction. And people be asking me, what's the matter with you? I say, well, I talked to Steven, and I think I'm concerned you're reading my thought, my ideas. Anyway, good stuff. So chapter 14 is titled Power. You share ideas about nonverbal communication and power. So let's talk about these power behaviors.
So one of the things to do is to be observant of behaviors. And are they trying to do a power play over you? And then also, who has more power as well? So the seating arrangement, usually the person in power sits at the head of the table or in the middle of the table, and then it sort of branches off from there. Second most powerful is usually to their right, and then it just goes down from there. So are they sitting at the head of the table or at the middle? And that indicates who's the leader. Maybe formally or informally. Maybe they're not formally designated as a leader, but they're sitting there thinking they are the leader. Maybe they sit higher in their chair than everyone else, trying to have higher status. One of the things that I talk about or write about in my book also is the handshake. So again, prior to Corona, people used to actually shake hands. And what that does is it gives you some indication about their emotional state, and it helps to increase the oxytocin level of other people. So it happened generations ago. We used to wear those long cloaks and then used to shake the other person's forearm to make sure there's not some sort of dagger that they could stab you with underneath their cloak, and then eventually evolved to shaking the other person's hand. So you could watch on YouTube Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. She walks out, she met with some foreign leader somewhere, and she walks out, takes a few steps and stops, and then realizes, oh, this other person's on my right side. Then she actually walks in front of the other person a few steps, and then she stops, and then they take a photo so that the other person is on her left side. So when they shake hands, she reaches across her body, her palm is down. The other person naturally reaches to their side. His palm is up, so she gives a power handshake because her palm is down. The other person has a submissive handshake because his palm is up, and what's that do? That exposes that very vulnerable vein that's very difficult to shut off if someone were to, you know, cut it by having your palm exposed. When President Trump met with the leader of North Korea, you could see him giving the power handshake where his palm is down. It's much harder. His handshake, and it's much more intense. And then also, one of the things that most people don't pick up on, they think someone's being polite when someone opens the door for them, when you're walking to a building or something, and then maybe they even touch you on the shoulder or on your back. But what they're actually doing, intentionally or not, is having a power play. They're trying to control your behaviors. They're telling you where to walk and what to do, and they're actually invading your space, and they're touching you as well. And that's one of the things that President Trump did with the North Korean leader is He often stood just slightly behind him, touched him, put his hand out, and showed him where to lead. So when you control someone else's behaviors, you have more power over the other person. Some other indicators are taking up more space, expansive, where we talked about the power pose, touching other people, having more possessions in the area that you claim. One of the things that you could do during a social interaction is to follow someone else's nonverbal behaviors. So mimic the other person's nonverbal behaviors. Do they touch a fork? Do they take a sip of water? Do they touch a piece of paper? Follow that for a minute or two, stop, and then do contrary behaviors that are different than what they're doing, and see if the other person starts to follow your nonverbal behaviors. And if they do, then you're the person in power.
That's awesome. I'm thinking about just the different ways that now I'm starting to think about the different interactions I've had and thinking, was that person trying to make sure that they got me to go where they wanted me to go? Is that what was going on there the whole time? That's nice. It really makes you think about some of that stuff and how it can be going back to something I asked earlier, how it could be misinterpreted if, not what you meant. Yeah. I followed up. Go ahead.
This guy's being so friendly, opened the door for me and touching me on the shoulder. Oh no way. He's being a jerk and trying to control my behaviors.
I like that. I don't know if I like it or not, but I like knowing it. There we go. How about that? That's pretty wild. Cause yeah, I've known some people who they definitely, that was their thing. And, as a note, one time I went into somebody's office and I said to somebody that knew the same person as me, I said, did you ever sit across from him at his desk? And they're like, oh yeah. And I said, do you notice that you sit a lot lower than what you normally would? And he had messed with the legs on the chair so that you sat lower than the person than him on the other side of the desk. And that was a funny feeling. You felt like a little kid, getting to meet the principal or something. It's like that was awkward.
You see that in the courtroom, the judge is much higher up. You go into a bank, they're much higher up.
It's interesting. I never really thought about that. Wow, it's all around us. this is wild. In chapter 21, workplace, you say nonverbal communication plays an important role in business. So why?
So one of the things that we talked about was a handshake, and then the power handshake. So having your palm down and the other person's palm up, and if they give you a power handshake, then maybe touch the top of their hand or maybe something more personal like their forearm or their shoulder to try to de-escalate their jerkiness of trying to overpower you. Personal space as well. If someone tries to invade your personal space, then maybe take a step closer to them as well. And again, touch them on the shoulder or the hand or whatever. One of the things that's been found consistently workplace, whether it's in the classroom or in a store or whatever else, is that each person's behaviors influences the other people's as well. So how well their personal kids, their grooming, their eye contact space, all those things can influence other people's as well. And one of the things that you want to think about if you want to build more rapport in business is be more open, not have barriers between yourself and the other person, having a book or a notebook or a cup of coffee or whatever else between you and the other person that creates a barrier. You want to lean forward with the other person. And again, you want to usually mimic the other person as well, their nonverbal behaviors. And that could come in eye contact length, breathing, how often you take a breath, the length of them, the speech, vocal expressiveness, how long do you talk, turn taken, all those things. So trying to match other people's nonverbal behaviors, whether it's vocalics or eye contact, facial behaviors or physical behaviors, can help build rapport. Also, having more natural types of things in the environment helps people relax. So having maybe plants in the office or a window or a poster of a window, all those things can help as well.
Yeah, I think that's that is so important what you just talked about, because there have been, over the last bunch of years, there have been some drives to try and eliminate stuff like that in people's offices because it makes it, you know, the thought behind it is that it makes it too feel like it's too much home, so therefore they want to stay in their office. And I've always had the opposite of that. I like my stuff, and it kind of relaxes me or whatever. And I think that's interesting what you're talking about.
In business, just one more thing is one thing that helps if you're having a virtual meeting and you have avatars for each person, have each person's facial features that they can express on each avatar helps people bond with each other as well. What's been found also is that the space, use of space, what we do in real life actually translates into online as well. So those you're in a closer relationship with, your avatar will stand closer to, and then you usually stand farther away with your avatar with people who you're less familiar with.
That's so powerful. One of the things that you've made me think about is, in commonplace in the workplace for you to shake hands when you're saying hi or welcome, come on into the meeting. Hey, I'm Steve, that sort of stuff. And I've never had this happen between myself and a woman colleague, but I have had this happen between males who sometimes you get into, like, you have to be the Incredible Hulk or something with your handshake because you're about to have this test to see whether you can withstand the pressure of the handshake, which it's like, nice,
And then use your left hand for a nice tap on their shoulder. That stops it.
That's cool. That's a good thing to know. To try that one. Cause I'd had a number of those. And then I've had the one where I'm waiting for that to happen. And instead it's the opposite. And it's like, I feel bad. Cause I just may have just crushed my hand. So yeah, it's like, oops. Nice. I love this information. All right. So Stephen, in the conclusion of your book, you have a list of 10 life lessons in this list. And it's kind of like a summation of everything that you've talked about. And I love this because it's kind of like a shortcut to the things that you're talking about to kind of remember, maybe I should put those near me when I'm getting ready to have a meeting or something. It's in this list, you share this. It takes knowledge about nonverbal communication deception to accurately determine other people's false communication. I think this is cool because you talk about people and false communication. Could you do that for a second?
Yes. So we touched on a few of the indicators, what direction they look at, more eye contact, the normal, fewer gestures, but also how happy is someone to see you when you meet with them. So one of the things when you come into visual sight with someone, if they're happy to see you, there's a universally found across cultures, across time, the eyebrow flash. So they automatically raise their eyebrows and lower them in less than a second for people they're happy to see. And for those they're not, they don't do it. Another indicator is a smile. And I go into detail in my book with that is how to determine whether a smile is genuine or not. So a genuine smile, takes longer to create. There's more symmetry on both sides of their face. The cheeks are raised much higher. And one of the strongest indicators is the crow's feet. So you have wrinkles on the sides of the eyes that indicates more of a genuine smile. So if you look at images, there used to be magazines, but maybe online, advertisements, the models, what do? They make their money off of a smile. They usually have a fake smile. A fake smile because if they have a real one, their career is shortened if they have these wrinkles on the sides of their face for 4 or 5 hours while people are taking pictures of them, and then it becomes more permanent. Also, it's usually with a genuine smile, their top teeth show, and their bottom teeth do not show on a genuine smile, but it does with a fake smile. So about 10%. So this is relatively pertinent to everyone, is only about 10% of the people in the population can fake a real smile when they're not genuinely happy to see you. And that probably coincides with 10% of the people in the population have some sort of psychological social disorder as well, severely. And then lastly, the left side of the face is usually more believable. And usually what emotion starts on their left side is what you want to believe. And what usually starts quickest and soonest is what you as well. So what happens first, what happens on the left, and what's her smile and eyebrow flash usually are good indicators as well.
I love this information. This is, although I wish I'd known you back when I was first starting in education, first went into the Army. There's a couple situations that I'm pretty sure I would have done a lot better with if I'd known some of this type of stuff. So this is awesome. We're coming to an end, and my last real question for you is this, Stephen. If you had a chance to talk to an audience of school administrators and teachers, what advice would you give them about working with peers, parents, and children in terms of nonverbal communication?
That I like to stress with my students, and I see a big need out there, is that our nonverbal behaviors, they indicate something about us personally, and they could change us as well. So people are always analyzing and assessing who we are as a person. It's a lot, the majority of it's based upon our nonverbal behaviors. So not only our gestures, our facial expressions, what we wear, what's symbolic about us. And one of the things is to be cognitively aware of it. I think there's a lack of self-awareness in our society, and particularly with the students that I see much more so, that they don't understand how other people see them, and they don't understand other people, they don't have awareness of other people as well as accurately as what they could. Another thing is that, like with anything that you try to improve upon, it takes knowledge and practice. And that's what my book, Nonverbal Epiphany, tries to do, is build that foundation of knowledge and then actually practice it, whether it's a sport, whether it's music, or whatever else. So just, and then that our nonverbal behaviors influence our behaviors as well, as we already talked about. If you're in a bad mood and you smile, that changes your emotion. So on that last note of self-awareness, one of the things that I touch on in the book is, let's say you're going to an interview, and what do most people usually carry in their hand to an interview? Their cell phone. Instead of carrying a cell phone, why not carry a newspaper, a periodical? If you're going for a finance job, carry the Wall Street Journal or Investor's Business Daily. One of our graduate students interviewed for a faculty position at another university, and I told him about this. So what he did was, before the interview, he walked into the lobby, and he picked up the school newspaper. And then he set that down on the desk during his interview, and they noticed that he has interest in the school itself from picking up the newspaper. So not just having a cell phone in your hand all the time can indicate what you have interest in and set you apart from other people.
That is awesome. I love it. That's, you know, talk about, cool. You know, they just walk in something there that says, hey, whether you did or not, it's, I was reading the school newspaper. I was curious, you know. I like that. That's nice. Love it. Good stuff. Good information. Stephen, if someone wanted to follow up and connect with you and or learn more, where would you send them?
And that's one of the things I find most gratifying about my books, is when I hear from other people who've read it and something that they personally can use in their life, personally and professionally. So if anyone wants to send me an email, feel free to stephen.furlich@tamuc.edu. And then I also have a website, drstephenfurlich.com, drstephenfurlich.com. And I have a few activities and some of my media appearances on that as well. And then for my books, the easiest way to do is just go on Amazon, go to the books category, and then just type in my last name, Furlich, F-U-R-L-I-C-H, and both of them pop up on there, and you could read more in-depthly what it entails, the different chapters and customer reviews as well.
Excellent. And I'll have those links in my show notes, so it's easy for my listeners to find that, which is cool. And Stephen, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your book, Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. What an awesome book. What an excellent topic. And you're just providing insight into, you know, incredible information that if we don't know it, oh my gosh, no wonder why some things never go right when people talk. Uh-huh. So good stuff. Thanks so much. Wishing you the best in all you do.
Thanks, Steve, for having me and your interest in it. And I'm glad to be of help with your audience and their job and personally as well with the information and improving their lives is what my purpose is.
Hey, you have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast to help you help kids achieve their dreams. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. Teaching Learning Leading K-12 is a member of the podcast network based in Canada called Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. The opinions expressed on Teaching Learning Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching Learning Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions. Teaching Learning Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Hey, thanks for listening. It would be awesome if you visited my website at stephenmoletto.com and connected with me, left a review, and listened to more episodes. And by the way, you could also share it with your friends, with your family, and your colleagues. Thanks so much. You're awesome.